Do I have your permission to record?
Yes, you have my permission.
This is Jacob Munson, tape 1, October 2nd, 2022, at Corpus Christi. I am interviewing retired Signal Chief Mark Test. Signal Chief, where were you born?
Good afternoon, Jacob. I was born in a little place, little town, a town about the size of Corpus Christi, up in Illinois, Peoria, Illinois. That's where I was born and raised. I went through K through 8 at Bellevue Grade School and then to a Limestone High School at that point.
How was your family life? Any siblings?
Yes, it was just myself and a younger brother, 2 years younger than me. Father, mother, typical, suburban family, small, modest house grew up in, and stayed in Bellevue, which was a suburb of Peoria. I think we moved there when I was about age 5 or 6, and then stayed all the way through grade school, through middle school, through high school, all in Bellevue, Illinois, in the same house.
Did you get along with your family members?
Yep, we did. Yeah, and that goes to say a lot, I think. Yeah, so hopefully, family relations are good. It makes it easier for the children, I think. Easier to succeed and be successful.
What elementary school did you attend?
Bellevue Grade School. That handled kindergarten through. It was basically the same school, kind of split in half. So it handled K through 6, I want to say, and then that was elementary, and then middle school was just 7th and 8th grade. Same building, just like different side, if that makes sense.
What did you for fun while in elementary?
Oh, in elementary, you got me. I mean, that was, we're talking about 5th grade and below. We did a lot of times, we had a lot of woods around, so a lot of outdoorsy stuff. So me and a couple friends would always... and my brother tagging along, we would always go, and there's creeks nearby, woods. We'd target practice with BB guns, and then later on go up to 22s and shotguns as we got older. So different times back then. Nobody freaked out when kids went into the woods with shotguns. So, and then now I'm getting into 7th and 8th grade, where we definitely would do hunting and fishing on our own up in the nearby woods.
How often did you hunt?
Pretty consistent from about age 10, because that's in the state of Illinois there, you had to get a hunting license and you had to be 10. But I like the way Illinois did it. I'm not sure about Texas, but you had to go through a conservation course. So I do remember that. And basically they taught you firearm safety along with what conservation is, taking care of the environment. Why there are quotas on how many deer you can take, how many rabbit, how many fish out of the streams, etc. So it was very enlightening and educational. So I did enjoy that. But so how many times? From age 10 to about age 13 or 14. And then after that, I started losing interest in it. And that's pretty accurate. Then just stuck to fishing after that.
In middle school, JV, did you develop any other hobbies or pastimes?
On the sports side, the athletics, I was decent at baseball around that time. So now we're talking 7th, 8th grade. I was a member of the local baseball team, some other baseball teams that played in the summer, like minors, super minor leagues, and basketball for a little while, organized in the school, right?
Were you part of the school teams?
Or? Yes. Wasn't a starter, rode the bench most of the time on both. I did better at baseball, if memory serves me right, and I really enjoyed playing catcher in baseball, right? So I did like that. But basketball I was okay at, nothing to write home about. So I was a decent second stringer.
Did you watch sports on TV as a during that time?
Pretty much started around 8th grade, getting interested, because of course now I think, thinking back, you want to learn the game, and what better way than to watch the pros play it? So I would say around eighth grade, if a baseball game was on or something, I would probably stick around and watch it. But honestly, I wouldn't go out of my way and say, okay, the Cardinals are playing, so I'm going to stop everything I'm doing on Saturday and watch them. So that was my team, my baseball team, still is the St. Louis Cardinals.
After middle school, mm-hmm. JV, what high school did you attend?
Yep, high school was Limestone High School in a little suburb again of Peoria known as Bartonville. So that was different, of course, going from an eighth grade class of 60 kids to 400 in my freshman class. So much bigger school going to high school and all that, but it was Bartonville High School way back in the day, class of 84.
Did you develop any new hobbies or pastimes while in high school?
Honestly, no. I dropped off the sports because a lot more competition in high school, and for me to be on a starter on either baseball or basketball would have taken a lot of practice on my part, and I just wasn't willing to. And also back then, nowadays they'd look at it as being, oh, that's harsh or mean. If you didn't make the top 20 out of those 200 kids trying out for, say, baseball, you left. That was it. The team was 20. That's it. So if you didn't make the cut, the coach would just say, sorry, you guys, you didn't make it. Didn't read off your names. Better luck next year. Back then, the coaches only dealt with the actual active players. So that was another reason, too. And I was like, well, I'm not going to put in the time. Primarily because I did have a job. Yes, even through, I worked as a paper boy from age 10 all the way to about age 15, so for 5 years. So before school, well, early Saturday and Sunday mornings, I peddled papers, and then after school every day. So even in high school as a freshman, I was working. So that took me away from any extracurricular stuff.
Did you like working as a paper boy?
I did, yep. It was very independent back then. So what I mean by that, and I wish they never took it away from this generation. But no, I was on my own. I had to order the number of papers I needed. I had to recruit subscribers. Every weekend, I had to go around door to door, knock on the doors, and collect the subscription fee, 75 cents or $1.50, whatever it was. Learn how to count back change, learn how to protect money, and earn money, more importantly. So you pretty much were, it's like a small little business of your own. So I did enjoy that. I really did. And making a couple hundred bucks every week was nice too, as a 14 or 15 year old.
Did you develop any interests in high school or ideas what to do after high school?
Well, believe it or not, a big thing on the hobbies, around the high school age now. Because probably starting my sophomore year in high school, I did get an interest in art, of all things. So that's probably attributed to the great art teachers that we had there in Limestone. So I would say, definitely art, drawing and painting, and a little bit of sculpture, too. So these things were all offered back then, too, so I did take them. So, but because that didn't interfere too much with my work schedule. Because now as I got into my sophomore, junior years, I actually worked downtown Peoria at the Peoria Public Library. So I was working, 25 hours a week while going to high school too. So that's one thing, art didn't get in the way of that. So I think I was pretty decent, but I did develop an interest in that, in art for sure, around my junior year.
After graduating high school, what did you plan to do after high school?
Same thing. You guys probably heard this story a million times, but it's true back then. So now we're talking about 1984, and like everybody before me and in my family, everyone's plan back then was graduate high school and go to work for Caterpillar Tractor. Peoria, Illinois at the time was the world headquarters for Caterpillar Tractor. And lots of plants. I mean, we're talking, in this area, it'd be equivalent of Kiewit maybe, or maybe a large refinery. So we're talking probably 75,000 jobs. So it was just expected if you were in good shape, good health, you know, you could go and get hired by Caterpillar Tractor. But of course, if you go back in American history, what was happening right there, a major recession, so they weren't hiring. So then it was like, well, I got a job at the library. Do I want to do this $3.50 an hour job, $3.50 I think I made then, or do something else? So I definitely wanted to get out on my own. I did do a semester in a community college, took a couple art classes, excuse me, a psych class. I think I took like maybe 9 credit hours. And college wasn't my thing either. Here I am, you know, sitting in a classroom paying for this. And so I just wanted to get out and do stuff. So the plan was go to Caterpillar and work like everyone else, my dad, my uncle, make $40, $50 an hour. But that fell through. And that led into talking to an Army recruiter first, of all things. Yeah.
So when Caterpillar wasn't doing as well, did it hit the community hard?
Oh, it did, it did. Yeah, it did. They started shutting down plants and all that. That's probably the beginning of some of the offshore work and stuff like that started happening in the 80s. I'm not sure on that, but yeah, it did strike the community pretty hard. Restaurants, you know, leisure things like movie theaters and stuff. Yeah, for sure.
The library job you did, what was your job in that?
I don't know if they still call it what it is, but my title when I started was a page. So the page is just the young man or young woman that gets the books as they're returned. We organize them and sort them, and then we go and put them back on the shelves in the right place. So I was a page. And then I worked my way up to being like maybe an assistant librarian, if you will, up in the art department. Checking out videos, VHS tapes back then, DVDs, albums too. You could check out music from the library, albums and tapes. So I did that before looking at the military as a career.
What made you choose to talk to an Army recruiter first?
Because I came from a family of Army. So my father was Army. My uncle, so the male members of the family were Army. My uncle was Army, my father was Army, and grandfather, my dad's father was Army as well. He was Army Air Corps, though, I found out later. So it just made sense. They were Army, so I would be Army. But that changed. So, and the reason it changed was my dad found out that I was talking to this sergeant and this Army recruiter. And I said, well, you were in the Army. And he said, exactly. He goes, that's why I don't want you in the Army. His words. And I said, oh, wow. So anyway, he invited the sergeant over, and then I found out why, because my dad knew what questions to ask the recruiter. For instance, what I learned, which to me today just blows me away, was there's no guaranteed school. There's no guaranteed MOS, at least back then. The Army would not guarantee an MOS, a job field. So, and that's what I wanted was a guaranteed trade. And his reasoning was everyone in the Army, this is 1984, 85, goes into infantry school first, everybody, for 2 years. So as a young man, I'm scratching my head. Wait, it takes 2 years to train somebody how to march, carry ammo, and shoot a rifle. And the sergeant said, yes. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. My dad was like, see? You know, he's like, yeah, no, of course it doesn't take that long to train somebody to do that. It takes maybe 2 weeks. So I didn't want any part of that. So then it was off to the Navy, because that's what my dad said. He suggested Navy or Air Force. Yeah.
Did your family solve it in any major wars or conflicts?
Very good question, right. So both my grandfathers, I should say, on my mom's side was on the USS Salt Lake City. That was an attack cruiser in World War II, primarily engaged in the Aleutian conflict in the Pacific. So he saw a lot of stuff, a lot of action, kamikazes and such not and whatnot. And then my grandfather on my dad's side served in the Pacific Theater as well, Army Air Corps. So he was island hopping with the Marines, I'd speculate. And then both my uncle and father served at least one tour. I think they just did one tour each in Vietnam.
So how did you get in contact with the Navy recruiter? How did it went?
It went very good, actually. He was a chief, I can't remember his name, many years ago. Really great outgoing personality, and what I picked up on him, that he seemed to be legit telling the truth. And later I found out he was. He just told it like it was. But by Navy, the Navy experience was walking into the, I'm basically a recruiter's dream, okay? I already had my high school diploma. Walked in and said, I want to enlist in the Navy. And they said, when? And I said, now. I thought that's how this works. And they said, well, slow down. And there's a little thing called an ASVAB. I said, okay. So they busted out the ASVAB, or no, I had to go to a recruit center like the next weekend. Scored very high on the ASVAB, and then all kinds of doors opened. So, and they liked me even more. So I wanted to go in now. You know, I could put in my 2 weeks notice from the library. I said, I just need 2 weeks to quit my job properly. And they were fine with that. And once my ASVAB score came in, they liked it even more and started negotiating for a rate and all that. And yeah, the rest is pretty much history after that. So I would say once I took that ASVAB, I was on the bus to Great Lakes, Illinois within a month after that. It was a very fast process.
When you got to the Great Lakes, Illinois, how did Navy boot camp went?
I was prepared for it, of course. I did talk to some Navy veterans because Army and, but I mean, boot camps are the same. So what my family had told me about basic training, their versions of it from the Army, even though it was two different generations, it was the same, pretty much experience is the same. It was probably, you know, you hear stories about the drill instructors beating up on people and things like that. And I didn't see any of that back in the 80s when I went through. And they had strict rules on that. So there was no violence or anything like that. Like you might see in some of the movies from the Vietnam era and earlier. But it was pretty much what I expected or what I had been trained for. Based on my dad said, the advice that I took was when you get there, just keep your eyes and ears open and your mouth shut and only answer when spoken to. And that's what I did for 8 weeks, and I got through it with no problems.
After Navy boot camp, what MOS did you pick, or did they assign you one?
Right, well, I had a guaranteed one, and that's what I liked about the Navy. It was guaranteed. Back at that recruiter station, based on my ASVAB scores, which if your listeners don't know ASVAB, it's the Aptitude Service Vocational Aptitude Barrier, or Armed Services, I'm sorry, Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. That's what ASVAB stands for. And very accurate. I think it's been in use since 1916. The Army started it. But based on what you score on the ASVAB, it puts you in a career field, a vocational field. So my aptitudes were strong in, like, science, a little bit of electronics in there. So anyway, by the time I had gone to Great Lakes, as long as I successfully upheld my end of a contract, because everyone signs a contract for 4 years of enlisted service, as long as I did what I was told and made the grades, I would become an ocean systems technician. So so that's what I, that was in my NEC, Navy Enlisted Code. So a little bit different than the other services. The Navy uses NECs. So that was my NEC, which we just remember them as rates. It's a four-digit number, just like the Army and Air Force, but I just remembered we go by our rates in the Navy, so an OT basically, an ocean systems technician.
And how was training for the ocean systems technician like?
Right, so after graduating from boot camp, which was step one of my agreement to Uncle Sam, to the Navy, graduate basic training on time to keep my school, I was shipped off to, got on a plane from Chicago, flew to Virginia, Norfolk, Virginia specifically, and that's where my A school, where they're gonna train me to be an ocean systems tech, and that was a 2-month school, if I remember right, about 8 weeks long. So again, this is my bias now towards the Army. I don't know why the Army needs to take years and years to train somebody to do a skill, one skill only. In my case, learning how to examine underwater signals and on a screen, and then look at classifying where those noise sources are. Are they a trawler? Are they a merchant ship? Or are they a surface combatant or a submarine? In 8 weeks, they did a pretty good job with us. They got us in and out pretty quick. So, but really enjoyed Norfolk. Never went back to Norfolk though, but Norfolk was okay, yeah. A lot of admirals there. It's close to Washington, D.C. too. Mm-hmm. So a lot of politics, yeah.
Was it nervous being around a lot of admirals?
Well, not so much. That's just a saying in the Navy. The further away you get from Norfolk, the less uptight your leadership is. Let's put it that way. Because, of course, you know, Norfolk, you're right by D.C., you got a lot of high-ranking people around that are just like 5 minutes away. So those commanding officers obviously really, really don't want to screw anything up to get the attention of an admiral. So the further away you are, you know, Japan, Adak, Alaska, Guam, all these places I've been, yeah, it's a little bit easier going. I mean, you still want to make sure you're doing your job right and everything, of course. Safety is always the number one concern. And you will still get the attention of Norfolk. It just seemed more lax the further away you are from Norfolk. So I always remembered that. Tried to take duty stations, East and West Coast, but not Norfolk. Very crowded, too. Norfolk's the largest naval base in the world, okay? Some think Murmansk is. It's Norfolk, and so it's crowded, too. Very crowded place. So great. Virginia's a great state, don't get me wrong, but just wasn't for me.
What did your right job entail?
Well, now we can talk about it. Back then, we actually had cover stories. So I can try not to bore your listeners too bad, but what a cover story is when you're asked, hey, what does an OT do, even by other Navy personnel? We had to say that, in order for the Navy to effectively operate in the ocean, you know, in the ocean, on the ocean, above the ocean, we need to understand it, basically oceanography. So we were told to tell them that that's what we do, we're oceanographers. We use electronical devices to monitor different things, ocean eddies, currents, salinity, blah, 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 all this physics of underwater sound stuff. That was our cover story. I can say it now because it's been reversed. Back in the 90s, we were all allowed to go back and say what we actually did, which we monitored the worldwide, and it was truly worldwide, underwater listening sources. Any Tom Clancy fans, he talked about it in The Hunt for Red October, Red Storm Rising. It was known as the SOSIS network. So all across the world underwater, we had these arrays, which are hydrophones, linked together that could pick up sounds of surface ships as well as submarines. And our main concern was finding the submarines. Because what your listeners may not realize, back in the Cold War, the 80s, it's getting towards the height of it. This arms buildup was crazy. 70, 80,000 nuclear weapons on either side, 400 submarines on their side, on our side, 400 folks. Okay, the fleets were massive back then. So it was a big deal to make sure their submarines didn't get in a position to hurt our carrier strike groups. And we did that pretty effectively. Or their missile boats, their Yankees, their Deltas, the Typhoons. Never ever had a shot of coming to periscope depth and launching their SLBMs, which each one missile would be able to take out 10 U.S. cities. And these guys carried 20, 24 missiles at a time. So it was kind of a big deal. So it was kind of exciting too. A lot of our data did go right to the NSA. A lot of times our data was briefed directly to the president, the White House. So it was pretty cool. But early on, it was tough because, like, can't say anything about, you know, you watch something on TV, go, yeah, I was there. I helped, you know, catch that boat, but weren't allowed to say anything. But now we can. And now it's moved on to what's called the IUSS system, Integrated Underwater Surveillance System. So, and who knows what they're doing now, because I've been out now for at least 10 years. So technology, the way it's moving, hopefully they're still doing good stuff out there. tracking any submarines that want to try to threaten America and our interest.
Is the job overwhelming or taxing at times?
It could have been. Yes, it was at times, yeah. That's like anything you guys see on the movies, any of your listeners, if you watch that, especially one of my favorite, I wasn't around for World War II, but Das Boot, I think that's an excellent movie, probably a better book, but a lot of periods of downtime where you're just bored. You're just cleaning stuff, fixing stuff, painting stuff. And then really, really quick things change, and now it's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of work. There's a lot of submarines rushing around your area of responsibility and stuff like that. So you had the doldrums that would last for months maybe, because the enemy's the enemy. You never know what they're going to do. Even though it's peacetime, we still practice the way we thought a war between NATO and the Soviet Union would go down. And the Soviets would practice and stress us. They would throw lots of contacts our way from submarines, aircraft, and surface action groups, or what we called them. So a lot of destroyers and frigates and stuff would come out with a lot of submarines. And that would go on for 2 or 3 weeks, really, really busy, and then 6-7 months with hardly a contact at all. So that was really the pace all through my experience of the Cold War.
When there was downtime and mm-hmm. all your tasks were done, is there any popular pastimes in the Navy?
Yes. Let me see. My first duty station was, because we were primarily shore-based as an ocean systems tech, was Adak, Alaska. So we had some arrays in that neck of the woods, and we worked 2-2-2-80. So that meant we worked 2 8-hour shifts. Let's say it started a day. It was a day watch, yeah. 2 days, so let's say you worked Monday and Tuesday, regular 7 to 3 o'clock day. Now the second day you got off at 3, you had to go back in at midnight or 11 o'clock at night and then get off in the morning, and then you had another mid-watch. And then the mid-eve was always a tough swing. We called these swing backs. You would get off at the mid-watch, you would get off at 7 in the morning, be back in at work at 3 p.m. But then you got 80 hours off, so that's the 3 days off. And those 3 days off, we were young, sailors being there, it was ADAC. I did do the outdoors stuff, so from fishing, some guys would go caribou hunting. There were caribou on ADAC, Alaska, small little island in the Aleutians. Mountain climbing, there was a mountain, I believe it was Mount Baker, if I remember right. Mount Sitka was on a different island. But learned how to mountain climb, cross-country ski, so do things like that. And, of course, you tried not to get in the rut of just drinking, because back then if you were in the service, you were at least 18 years old and everyone would serve you. So alcohol and alcohol problems could be a problem if you went down that. So I realized that early on. I'm not saying I was an angel, but, yeah, we did drink a lot. But I did try it. As time went on, I was like, well, this is stupid. So there's so much to do here. So good MWR, morale, welfare, and recreation facilities on there. So you could rent skis. Fencing, we did fencing. I forgot about that. We actually tried fencing, the whole suits and the mask. So instead of just drinking your life away while we were there. And it helped make the time pass. So going outdoors and doing stuff there in ADAC, which was very, very rural. And Alaska's a beautiful state, yeah. So that was pretty much the life there. And then, of course, you get older and, you meet people all around the world. Just any advice to anyone going into service, I'll throw this out here to your younger viewers that are thinking about military service, stay out of the bars. Just get out there. And so if you're overseas, you're in Tokyo, maybe go have a drink or two at a club, experience that, of course, some dancing and nightlife. But get with those MWR services and get out there and do stuff during the day, you know, go out there and learn about the culture and everything. So, and I did, and I ended up doing that route, and I'm glad I did.
After your first duty station in Alaska, what was your next duty station?
From ADAC, I went to a place called Broughty Wells. There's no such thing as Broughty. Broughty was just the name of the Royal Air Station. So now I'm with the British, working with the UK, and another listening outpost in the Eastern Atlantic. And we were actually stationed in a little town in Wales called Haverford West. So I took a train from London all the way to Haverford West, which, if you know your geography of the UK, London is kind of south central, and Haverford West was like all the way to the western side of Wales, southwestern corner, if I remember right. Ended up renting a house, and this the first thing blew me away. The house that I lived in and a couple roommates was built in, it was either the 1400s or the 1500s. So right off the bat, I understood that Europe was around a lot longer than America. So here I'm living in a house that's 500 years old and still standing, so it was amazing. So a little farmhouse in a place called Solva, a little small village. And that's where I ended up meeting my wife. She was a petty officer in the Navy. Our paths crossed there at Wells, and we got married in Wells. Got a Welsh wedding certificate. So I think that's pretty cool. It's all in Welsh. It's interesting language.
How did you meet your wife while there?
At work. That was one of the selling points for going the OT route back at a place called MEPS. That's the job I qualified for. So my recruiter can't back up a little bit. So way back in 1985, my recruiter can't guarantee the job. That's what's called MEPS. So you do that, and they still do MEPS. So that was in Chicago as well. I went to Chicago. It was prior to boot camp. And that's where they assign your job. So they got to make sure that you're not crazy and that you're physically fit to serve. So that's what MEPS is. It's a day of different tests, psych and physical test. And then when you pass those, you sit down at a computer with another sailor behind the computer monitor, and they plug in your scores. And OT came up, and they weren't happy. These guys were some submariners on the other side. They knew exactly what OTs did, and they were upset that I got like a very, like it's a unicorn type job. Very rare that this job pops up. So the reason they were just, you know, not upset at me, they just were like blown away that I got lucky. I hit the lottery, basically. And the reason being, as an OT, I forgot to say this earlier on, the selling point for me, selling point for all of us, was it's shore-based, and it was shore-based duty, shore-based duty, and 80% female, maybe 90%. So that's how I met my wife. We, it was probably at that time 9 to 10, nine women for every one man. So that's, yeah, so at work in the Navy is how I met my wife. On watch, yeah. And as long as you didn't do any hanky-panky at work, obviously, it was fine. And, yeah, you're allowed to fall in love and marry and all that.
Mm-hmm. How long did you knew her before dating?
Oh, okay, well, we knew her before dating, I don't know, about maybe a few weeks, possibly. But I think we did it the right way. That is, when we started dating, I had space, and my roommates were okay with it too. And so we actually lived together for well over a year. And we didn't drive each other crazy and all that kind of stuff. Now, this time too, the Navy realized we were a couple, so they split us up. And then that's correct. I mean, I think that policy should still be there. And you do that by you go to the command and say, hey, we're dating. And then they'll split us up so that there's not a conflict there of me showing favoritism towards her because I was senior. I was about a year in the Navy more than her, so I think she was a seaman and I was at least a third class, maybe a second class petty officer, which is an E5. So that way there's no way of showing any type of favoritism. So she went to a different watch team. And we still dated, lived together for about a year, and then decided to tie the knot and get married. So some people might say that's living in sin, but I don't know. I recommend it to my kids, so, to do that first. And it's worked. I've been married since 1990. So what is that, 30 years now, Jacob, I think?
I think 32.
Yeah, 32 years if my math is right. Yeah. So it worked for me, but because it worked for me, it doesn't mean it worked for anybody else. But yeah, that's the story of where we met and how we met and all that. Was in the Navy. Yeah.
How big was the ceremony? Did any family members came?
No, we were overseas like that. So it was just justice of the peace type wedding. We did have a church wedding the day after. So the Welsh magistrate married us down in Haverford West at the courthouse. And then that following Sunday, the immediate Sunday, we rented out basically or reserved the base chapel. So we did have a good 40 to 50 friends of ours. They were friends. None of the family made it. We planned on going back to each one of our families, my family in Illinois, hers in Kansas, once we had our leave when we transferred from England. And that's what we did. So we had about 40 to 50 guests at the church there on the chapel on the Royal Air Force side of the base. So that was nice. That was nice. And then, of course, we went home and caught up and exchanged gifts and all that, met all the family. She got to meet my family. I got to meet her family. Well, we did 2 to 3 weeks on leave. Yeah, that's how that works. So you can see sailors, military, we still have lives. We still live lives, normal like anybody else.
How was it at Wells? The people and culture, what was it like to be there?
If I could go back there, I'd go back in a heartbeat. Awesome people, awesome culture. Of course, that's where, you know, we as Americans come from. You know, we fought our independence from the English, as the Welsh would say. The Welsh don't like to be mixed in, nor do the Scots with the English. They reminded me there that, yeah, you weren't fighting the Welsh, you were fighting the English. We're part of the United Kingdom now, but back then. So I learned that Arthur Pendragon, you know, so the myth or whatever of King Arthur was, he was Welsh. Got to see King Henry VIII's castle, go through that, and that was in Cardiff, Wales, which I think is their capital of the country. So that was, I mean, a lot of great history. I mean, it's just amazing. You go overseas, see the old world, the old country. I mean, King Henry VIII sat in the throne. I was, you know, 6 feet away from it. You know, all that history and stuff that's there, just amazing, amazing. And then get to see Europe while we were there. Got to go through Belgium, Germany, France, Italy. And that's something. I mean, if you're in England, you can get in a car, go across the channel. We had to get on a ferry back then. Now you got the channel, drive under the channel, pop up in France. You can have a nice French dinner and then still get back the following morning for work. Or take a couple days and you could go all the way down to Italy and have a real good Italian pasta dinner and stuff. And legit, you know, Austria was there. It was just amazing being there, that Europe, and realizing how large America is. Europe is very, very small. I think if you put Europe, the European, Western Europe on a map of America, it might cover New England, the New England size. So that's what I learned about. The people were great. Actually, people everywhere I've been, from the Middle East to the Far East to Europe, we're all the same. And I think any veteran will tell you that. You know, what do I mean by we're all the same? We all just want to live our lives and take care of our kids. That's pretty much what every man, woman, and child, you know, that I've ever encountered all across the globe, that's all they want. You know, our government's kind of getting in the way of that, right? That's, I'm not going to go down that hole. That's a whole different politics. We'll keep out of that.
Did you and your wife have any pastime activities, Valdo?
Pastime. Other than sightseeing, yeah, I would say sightseeing, right. Our honeymoon actually was a 2-week, what they called a coach trip. So a coach over in England is a bus. So it was a bus trip in two weeks. So that's where we got to see all of Western Europe. Now, we couldn't go to places like Poland or Czechoslovakia, which were right there next to us once you cross the channel, because it was still the Cold War, and the Berlin Wall was still up, and East versus West, and American active duty could not go to Eastern Europe because they were communist. So, but that was probably the big thing is, yeah, we both like to travel and see the sights. Went to Loch Ness quite a few times. Camped out over there in England a few times and things like that. So being outdoors is traveling, seeing the country. Like I said, not sitting at a bar all day drinking your life away. Get out, see the people, meet the people, see the countryside. And she was into that as well. So that was one of our common interests we both had.
after being stationed in the UK, mm-hmm. where was your next station?
Then from the UK, I went on to Keflavik, Iceland. So we had another listening post up there. So Iceland. Again, Iceland, phenomenal. That was a short tour, I think, 2 years, which goes by pretty fast. But lived on base housing there. Just amazing. And the volcanoes, you saw a volcano every day in Iceland going off. Lots of earthquakes, too. And busy. It was busy up there where Iceland was at. Now we're getting closer to the Norwegian Sea. The Norwegian Sea, if you don't know, goes into the Murmansk. So that's the head submarine and surface fleets of the Russian Navy. So, and that was during the transition. While I was in Keflavik, now we're talking early 90s. That's when the wall fell down. And now we were all really bored because those 400 ships, those 400 submarines that the Soviets were putting to sea, they were broke. They no longer had any money to pay for them. And now we were looking at, ooh, what are we going to do? The writing was on the wall. There's no need for all of us OTs anymore. And that segues into, they merged us at that point. They gave us a choice. We could go to aviation warfare specialists and do sonobuoy monitoring with the P-3 aircraft, which is now the P-8 Poseidon. I don't quote me on that, but it's the P-8 aircraft we have now. Long-range reconnaissance aircraft that use all kinds of sensors to keep an eye on folks, including underwater hydrophones, which is my specialty. So they offered us that pathway, or we can basically straight convert us, a stroke of the pen. So one day I was an ocean systems technician, the next day I became a sonar technician, you know, just like that. And it crossed over just fine. But that opened up now STs instead of being, like I came from a rate that was shore intensive, 80% of my job would be at shore. Now I went to where 80% of my job would be at sea, on board a ship. And I love sea duty, so it was a blast once I got underway and got to ships. I liked it, so it worked out. And I figured I owed the Navy some sea time anyway, because my first 10 years was all shore duty. It was all overseas, but it was, ADAC was overseas duty, Iceland, Britain, Hawaii even counts as overseas duty. I did a little bit of time in Hawaii. So went ST and then started going to sea, doing the same job, just at sea, though.
Was there any difficulties on your first time at sea?
That's a very good question. That's the downside, definitely, for sailors, is the separation. Because up until this point, me and the wife, both active duty, and we had Brandon, our firstborn, we had our son in 91 as the wall fell down, and now we have to now choose, well, who's going to stay, you know, the shore bay side, who's going to go to sea. We decided, both of us, that it should be me. And then is the separation. So, and then especially now you've got children to take care of. So it's tough. That's the challenge. And it was. But you adapt to it as a family. We'll say this, you know, the Navy wives, they've got to figure stuff out. If the husband, or vice versa, if it's the dad that stays behind and the female sailor goes to sea, because, I mean, we're talking deployments 6 to 8 months, 9 months. You get a leaky faucet, your car breaks down. That spouse that's left behind has to figure all that out and know how to do that. So by themselves, plus take care of the kids. So it's a tough job, too. So shout out there to the Navy spouses that hold the home front down. Because that's no joke. Because honestly, it's kind of a break for us, the dads. We get a 6-month vacation, if you will. I mean, think of it. We're every 3 days we're pulling into a different city. Tokyo on Monday, and then maybe it's Brisbane, Australia, the following Monday. So we're seeing the world out there, plus doing our job protecting America, of course. But we're not dealing with stuff like leaky faucets and broken cars and that kind of stuff, crying babies, sick children and all that, so it's kind of a break for them. You know, we're just doing our job at sea, that's all. So big shout out for the Navy spouses to do that.
What's the difference from a sonar technician and your previous task?
The difference, not much, because those STs rolled right into our shore-based facilities. We still have a few of those left. Of course, a lot of them closed down with all those submarines going away. There was no longer a need for that wide range of coverage. So, but the STs were easily able to just go right in and do what I did. Basically, it's just, how would you listeners, you're listening for underwater sounds, but on different type of gear, different type of, maybe an analog versus digital. So just some minor nuances you had to pick up, different displays, different frequency ranges. That was a big thing. I mean, once you got your eyes and ears adjusted to what was going on where you're at, it was easy. So it was fairly easy for me, and I think most of my OTs going to ST, where the ships have a towed array. So my array was a fixed array on the seabed. Now I just had to understand this array that I'm looking at now is moving through the ocean at, say, 10 knots, 12 knots, whatever. And so now you've got target motion analysis, which is, I didn't have to do much TMA where I was at, but now I had to do more math once you go to a ship and do it. That was the only difference, but once you figure it out, it doesn't take long. Sorry, Army, they didn't send me for 2 years to learn TMA. You learn it in one mid-watch. You do. And we have cheat sheets and stuff and checklists to use, too, to make sure you're doing it right. And, of course, now you have the computer, but I like the way I learned it. I learned it on paper first, how to compute it in my head, and then check the computer. Because then you're just double-checking the computer to make sure it all adds up.
What was the first ship you were deployed on?
The first ship that I was deployed on, it was actually a USNS, and I don't know which one. There were so many. I was on about five or six of them, but I want to say it was, I don't know which one was the first. I should, because it's a big deal. I'm leaning toward the research vessel Corey Swest, but it might have been the USNS Assertive. All of these were basically the hydrophone systems that we had fixed under the old Solstice network, those same listening devices we were able to put on surface ships and tow them through the water, meaning they're mobile. They could pick up, transit to a different spot in the water, put the array in the water, and have this really, really good acoustic listening device anywhere in the world. So, it was USNS ships. So let's just say it was probably the Corey Schwest. I want to say that was probably the first one. And that was an interesting gig. I liked it. The Navy would fly what they called a detachment. So myself and maybe 12 other sailors, we'd get on a plane, fly to maybe Guam, fly to Tokyo, and catch the ship there, and which it was a permanent civilian manned crew, the Merchant Marines, Military Sealift Command. And us sailors would get on board, and we would operate all the gear. And those guys would maintain the gear. So if we broke something, they would fix it. So it was a pretty good working relationship. So those are my first ships that I went on, USNSs. And there's at least a half a dozen. And it's they're all blurring in my head. The Assertive, the Victorious, the Effective, the Impeccable, the RV Corey Schwest, and probably a couple others. Yeah. Good times, though. Those were good times.
Was the job more demanding? Was there any free time while on board the ship?
Yeah, a lot of free time. Even in today's fleet, when you move to an actual warship, these were not warships by any means, had no armament. We were completely unarmed. So there, you were a worker. You're like any other civilian, you really were. You put on the uniform, normally Navy coveralls underway. And we stood 12-hour watches, so 12 on, 12 off. But our watches are sitting at a sonar console, and every couple hours you would rotate to a different console so you're not getting bored, falling asleep, because you do want to keep your alertness up, monitoring all the systems that we have. So, and sonar shack would have 6 to 7 guys in it, you know, a watch chief. And, sometimes it could be a busy watch, go by real fast. Other times, you're sitting there just talking about knowledge and, you know, always learning stuff and practicing stuff. But it was very interesting from there, and then going to a Navy warship where the pace is a lot different there. So a lot of free time on the USNSs, to answer your question, mm-hmm. Yeah. PlayStation, play a lot of cards, because you got 12 hours off. You're not going to sleep for 12 hours. You don't. So a lot of free time.
What's the big difference between a USNS and US VOLSIP in terms of how it's like to walk low?
Everyone stands watch on a warship. I went to my first combatant was USS Pelican in MHC, so a mine hunter coastal here in Ingleside, Texas. And a lot of work. I just say a lot of work. So I'm a sonar tech, but now I'm on a mine hunting sonar, so which was easy to pick up, the SQQ-32, active sonar. It's an active sonar 24/7. And here the TMA was reversed. A mine, a bottom mine, is not moving. The ship is, the target's not. Vice tracking a submarine, you're moving and he's moving. In this case, it was a lot easier because now I'm the only one moving, he's not. So working on the mine hunting sonar set, the Squeaky 32 as we called it. So I would stand typical 6 hours in sonar / combat, and then 4 hours on the bridge, learning how to drive the ship and be an officer of the deck underway, running fire drills, running combat system training team, damage control training team. So busy running drills, navigation training team, because by now I'm a chief petty officer when I got to Pelican. So I'm in a leadership position. So a lot of training and a lot of real-world ops. And what I learned in the on the surface warfare side of the Navy, you work 6 hours on, let's say, and you got 6 hours off. You don't get to go to your pit and go to sleep. You have to go fix what you broke. So that was the difference. We don't have those civilians on a warship to fix our gear. So if anything breaks while we're there, we got to go fix it. So you might get two on a minesweep. I don't know what it is now, but you know, a few years back, on a minesweep, you would get maybe 2 to 3 hours of sleep a day. It was rough. It was rough. You'd spend a week out, it felt like a month. And that's what the MNC, Lucas, Chief Lucas told me. He was an engineman. ENC, he said, yeah, Mark, it feels like a month underway, you know, when we're just a week out. And he was right. Then I look back, and that's why. 2 to 3 hours of rest every day. And that's from the officers to the enlisted guys. So it was tough duty. But it was enjoyable. It was rewarding. That's the word, rewarding. To survive something like that for 3 years, that you went through all of that and made it, you know, without losing your mind. So there's a difference. And everyone's a firefighter on a warship. Okay, those USNSs, I'm pretty sure, well, I know for a fact, my general quarters station for shipboard fire was lifeboat. Lifeboat 1 or lifeboat 2. Okay, and we didn't fight fires on USNSs. You push the automated system. If it put out the fire, great. If it didn't, you abandoned ship. Okay, that was a big difference. Where I was on a warship, everybody fights fires. So being on a fire party as well was a wake-up call. So, yeah, but very enjoyable. I'll look back at it. And the reason it was enjoyable, I realize now all these years, is I just had great people around me. And that makes any job, career that you're in, is just being surrounded by great folks makes it worth doing.
What responsibilities did you have as a senior enlisted? Mm-hmm.
Very good, senior enlisted. I took up the role as command chief, so I was dealing with the wives of the sailors. All the sailors with any issues would come to me first, and then I would take those to the captain directly. So as a senior enlisted advisor, you know, in that role, yeah, I report directly to the CO themselves, and which was a lieutenant commander, possibly a commander at the time, depending on which ships I was on. So yeah, that was interesting times, tough job, being a command chief. Work with the XO a lot, with the captain, because captain's busy with stuff. But and basically just making sure every enlisted guy, you're their voice to the captain. How's morale? Hey chief, what could we be doing better to make these guys' lives a little bit easier? Things like that. And make recommendations, and sometimes the captain would agree, sometimes not, and because it always developed, everything revolves around the ship schedule, what the ship has to do. Orders are orders, and you're going to have to do those things. So that was one of my duties, and then it was a combat systems chief. That's what my specialty at that time was. So I learned things about Harpoon, Aegis, the VLS systems on various warships. So even though I was on a minesweep, that's still valuable knowledge to have once we start working with destroyers and cruisers, which we did quite a bit, especially over in Bahrain in the 5th Fleet AOR. So, so combat systems chief, mine warfare specialist, learned to be an OOD underway, special evolutions OOD, for replenishments at sea and all that kind of stuff, standing up and driving the ship during those times. So a lot of hats, a lot of duties. And that's one thing that, I liked about the Navy for me was if you're willing to learn the job, whether it be working on an engine or working on a sonar, most captains are going to be okay with that. It's called on-the-job training. And there's even qualifications you can do to get certified without going to a school. So I like that, yeah. I think most guys do, too. Because that's how you get ahead. Contrary to what some people say, I've heard on the news that they say the U.S. military is a socialist outfit. We're not. We're called a meritocracy. So for your listeners there, I just want to get a meritocracy is merit. What are you worth? The more you're worth, the more you get. So the Navy definitely allows you to learn as many jobs and skills as possible. Makes you more valuable. And even in the civilian sector, it makes sense. The more valuable you are to your boss, the more perks you're probably going to get. Yeah. But, sir, that's unfair. No, it's not. It's not unfair at all.
What is it like being a mediator to junior enlisted to officers?
It can be tough at times. You could understand it because it kind of is an us versus them. Let's see, for civilians, the union versus the CEO, the company, and you got a steward, if I remember right, a union steward, that's the middleman. So you're definitely the middleman, and it's us versus them in the fleet. Officers versus the enlisted guys. Officers want to crack the whip and make the enlisted guys just work, get every ounce out of them, and you got to make that balance. If you keep doing that, if you lead that way, well, you're going to get these guys tired out, burned out, accidents happen. That was my number one concern. Someone's going to get hurt. The ship's going to get damaged. Equipment could get damaged. So as a chief, and then later as a senior chief, my number one, it's always safety. If we can't do this safely, Captain, we shouldn't be doing it at all. And 9 times out of 10, most of my commanding officers agreed with that philosophy too. But just finding that balance, because you got to keep the guys' spirits up. You got to understand that the officers have a job to do too. It's called the mission. We got to do the mission. And just find the balance, and usually that is work hard, play hard. If you want the guys to do this job and get it done right, they're going to have to put in many, many hours above their 8-hour work day. So maybe reward them with a little port call in Veracruz, Mexico, or Key West, Florida was a blast. And that's kind of, in my experience in the Navy, that's kind of what happened, okay? The officers upheld their end of the agreement. These enlisted guys busted their butts to get the job done, and we had 3 or 4 days of liberty in a fun place. That's kind of how I was able to balance that. But,
Was there any major incidents or accidents on any ship you were on?
Some close calls. I'll leave it at that. Some close calls, but luckily they never amounted to it. And luck, maybe, things like that, but... for instance, like when I was on the Corish West, the RV Corish West, we had our towed array out, many, many, many feet long out there, plus many, many feet long of a tow cable, which is solid steel strands. And it was the middle of the night off the coast of Hawaii. I was on watch. I was a chief then. Very close call. And what had happened was we had lost control of the ship. So the ship was in like a hard left, if I remember right, hard left rudder. And the systems went down. So it was all ahead, hard left. So now we're doing about 10 knots. They weren't fast ships. They didn't need to be fast. And stuck in a port turn, turning to left. Well, the cable's still out in the water, the array. So if you guys can imagine, so now it slid all the way over to the left side of the boat, of the ship. And I run immediately to the fantail, because that's my array. I'm the OIC, officer in charge. And if you lose an array, and some did, if you lose an array, you're fired. I mean, that's so, even though, oh, but sir, it's not your, well, there's something you can still be doing, right, to get this. So go back there, and it's arcing and sparking, and it's like, it doesn't look good. I run up to the bridge, and right away, before any of this, they said, Chief, we're on it. We understand. So I shut up. I didn't say anything about them. It was just, it was luck. And within a couple more minutes, they fixed the casualty. And we did not lose the array that night, and just minimal damage to the tow cable, which we had parts and material on board to replace, and we did. So that was pretty scary, though. You get a towed array out there, and then your ship just decides to go left or right all on its own. So loss of steering control happens. It happens on their computers fail, and some computer systems will do that. So, and then you're helpless there trying to get manual control. Yeah, that was a big one that I still remember to this day.
Did you ever hear of any stories in the Navy about major accidents or incidents?
Oh, heck yeah. And how to learn from them. The Navy, I hope, is still doing good safety practices. When a ship did do something bad, like I want to say it was the USS Radford, she ran into a merchant ship at night off the coast of Virginia. And that's the one example that when we learned from it. So it's called after action reports. The whole fleet is brought up to speed on what broke down on that ship, what broke down. And usually it's human. The human error comes into play. So it was poor watchstanding in her case. That allowed a ship to get too close to her and ram into her. So yeah, you just have to be alert and things like that. So that I would always teach my combat guys, because it's 3 a.m, you're in the middle of the ocean, there's not a whole lot going on. Guys will nod off, go to sleep. So I was always would bring up that and teach them and train them. That's exactly how ships can get, run into. And oh, by the way, we're on a minesweeper. We're pretty small. So if that Group 3 tanker out there hits us, we're all dead. And I don't want to die. So, and then keep the guys up, keep talking to them, pop in on them from time to time, talk about anything, baseball, football, keep them active so that they're at least looking on the scope, in this case, the surface search radar. And following basic watchstanding procedures, yeah. When those break down, and I'm going to look at the Fitzgerald as an example and the McLean, both Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, very sophisticated, a few years back got hit off the coast of China, both of them by Group 3 merchant ships. Never should happen. I can only speculate. I won't, because I wasn't there, but I would guess poor watchstanding led to those ships closing that close to them, where they actually collided. Yeah. So, yeah, that's, so we do, we learn firefighting, what works and what doesn't, those kinds of things. Yeah, the Navy is, to this day, I'm pretty sure, still very open on that, okay? Don't hide your mistakes, learn from your mistakes, and move forward. And that's good advice, guys, in any field that you're in. Learn from our mistakes, move forward.
What was your favorite posting on the ship?
Oh, that's a good question. Other than being off watch is probably going to be any sailor. Yeah, being off watch where my rack, I could be in my rack, my bed, which is your bed. I actually did enjoy, once I, made it up to a senior chief, officer of the deck underway, taking a 4-hour shift at night up on the bridge. You're there. You're the captain's eyes and ears. He or she trusts you to take care of the ship while he's getting some shut-eye. It's a big responsibility, and just seeing the ocean at night, the Milky Way. Yeah, I would say standing a topside watch on a quiet watch with nothing going on was good times. Or just being off watch and getting up in the middle of the night, going out to the fantail, having conversations with other sailors that are off watch, yeah. That was the enjoyable part of surface life in the Navy. Those submariners are stuck under the water. They don't get that.
What ship was your favorite ship you were assigned to?
Oh, I would have to say, oh my God, that's a tough one. They're all so good. For living accommodations, any of the USNSs, because at one time I had my own stateroom, which means my own head. But typically on the USNSs, the creature comforts were much nicer. Large lounges, couches and that kind of stuff, nice big screen TVs, four-man stateroom, I'm sorry, two-man stateroom, two to a room and you share a head, so four men to a head. That was easy living. But I actually enjoyed the challenges on Pelican, because when I arrived on Pelican, she was a broke ship, had a lot of engineering issues, and me and ENC motivated the guys, and I still got a soft spot in my heart there for the mighty MHC 53, Warship 53, USS Pelican. I'd have to say that was very rewarding, because it was a tough 3 years. And again, but because of surviving that and getting the ship underway day in and day out, I'd have to say the Pelican.
What was the last Navy ship you were stationed on?
That would have been MCM 13. She's home ported in Bahrain, off the coast of Saudi Arabia, USS Dextrous, the Dextrous. That was my last one. And a good boat, too. She was a good boat, good crew.
When did you retire from the Navy?
That was December 31st, 2009. Long time ago, yeah. That's right, yeah.
What made you decide to retire?
Good question. That's another good one. What made me retire is I was no longer being surprised. By that I mean challenged. No matter what a sailor did, no matter what op tempo there was, what op sked came, where we were operating in the world, I'd already been there and done that. So no more challenging. It wasn't challenging anymore. So that made up my mind to go ahead and put in the papers to get out.
Did your wife retire around the same time or before?
No, my wife, she did 9 years, so she didn't get to retire, but she's a 9-year Navy veteran. Yeah, she just chose at that point with me going to sea that it would be best for her to stay home with Brandon, and then later on with Vanessa when we had our daughter. So she chose to not re-enlist and just finish out her 9 years. That's what she did.
How was family life, or just in family life, after retiring?
Easy. Family life took a little while, because again, I'm out of the picture most of the time. Now I'm in the picture all the time. So that maybe a 2 to 3 month adjustment with the family side of it. And civilian side was no problem whatsoever. I mean, really, we used to joke about it in the 80s, you know, the commercial was the Navy, not just a job, an adventure. We used to always say, Navy, it's not just a job. Yeah, it's just a job. It really is. So work is work. We all got bosses. We all got dress codes, et cetera, et cetera. So the transition for me, at least, I can just speak for me, was pretty standard going to the civilian sector. Places I worked in the civilian sector, safety, already drilled into my head, you know, in the Navy, so that all made sense. So, yeah, a couple month transition for family, and I would just say pretty much instantaneous for civilian sector.
What work did you perform in the civilian sector?
I went to my first gig after getting out and retired down here in my house is in Portland, Texas. I worked the waterfront, fixing USNS ships, oddly enough, the roll-on, roll-off ships that pull in to the port of Corpus Christi. So I took various contractor jobs and did anything from insulation work, running cable, that kind of stuff. So, again, long hours. Contract was the ship's in for 2 weeks, meaning you're going to work 2 weeks straight, no weekends off and all that. Got paid weekly, though. So I did that, and so back on the ship again, duh, you know, everything was the same, just not wearing a uniform. So did that for a few months, and then I moved on over to the USS Lexington and worked there 5 years, being the lead coordinator on the overnight program.
How did you got hired by the Lexington?
I spotted the opening on Craigslist. They had advertised on Craigslist, and I put in for it. Got in touch with the HR people that were actually running it for the Lexington. Anyway, long story short, I went in. I applied for the job, sent in my resume to the HR people on board Lex. they liked what they saw on the resume, called me in, I interviewed well, and the rest was history. I got hired probably like 2 to 3 days after the interview.
What jobs did you perform on the Lexington?
Well, I was my official title was overnight coordinator. So I was the head overnight coordinator. And we took care on a typical Saturday night up to 500 youth groups, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, Brownies, NJROTC, JROTC groups. So youth groups from all over the state, up to 500. We could board up to 500 adults and their children on board the ship every Saturday night. Very challenging. Plus, I had to put on a 30-minute patriotic show there, reminding everybody about the importance of this country, the Constitution, what the flag stands for, all that good stuff, too. Because the youth of America should be reminded of that, yeah. All the sacrifice our forefathers gave up to make sure we could stay free. So that's what I did, so I enjoyed it. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
How large were the youth groups normally?
Oh, you could have them all together. They would total up to 500, but you could have a scout group, particularly a Cub Scout group, average size probably 75 little 8-year-olds running around and just making sure they stayed safe. Yeah.
Any particular part you liked about the job?
No, the entire job. Great people on the Lexington, too. That made it very easy to go to work. So enjoyed the job. The people around me were great to work with, good team. And even though it was a bunch of civilians, there were some veterans in there. There were some veterans like myself that were working there, some Navy veterans. But half the guys and gals there were civilians. They had never served in any branch. But it was definitely run like a crew. So, I mean, something needs to be done. If you can do the job, you rose your hand and go took care of it. And that's what shipboard life is like. I mean, you're here. Why not help us out? Why not learn this skill? So a lot of cross-deck training happened on board Lex, too, and I enjoyed that.
For tours, what type of tours did you give?
What kind of tours? Really, that wasn't in our job title. Unofficially, and I had volunteers that worked with me, unofficially we would give adults and teenage groups a midnight tour. So after hours, the younger kids are asleep, take them around off tour and show them some of the spots. Talk about some of the paranormal, of course. I did take about 3 or 4 while I worked there, 3 or 4 paranormal groups around. And that was kind of interesting. Most of the time, nothing happened. But there were a few times where, yeah, I don't know how to explain it, but stuff would happen. Because we prank everybody on the ship. It's a haunted ship, so we go around, make noise, scare the customers, the tourists as well. So I know all the tricks, and I know what a human-made sound sounds like. There was some stuff sometimes I couldn't explain. Yeah, on a couple of these paranormal things. So there might be something to it. There might just be.
Was the haunted legs around before, or was that a decision to do so after you got the job?
Oh, you mean the haunted house that they do every year?
The haunted stories.
Oh, that goes back to, that goes back to probably the late 40s. It's, because there was a lot of loss of life on there, you know. I think, seven souls passed away when a torpedo struck her starboard stern. Two of them vaporized. One was tossed overboard. And that's something to imagine, guys. A 40,000-ton ship got blown out of the water enough to make a crewman on the flight deck get thrown overboard. Two vaporized, and then the remaining, their parts were found, body parts were found. When they pulled in the Pearl, the remains, and then buried at that point. Because the compartments were flooded, they tell me, and they just isolated the water, got back to Pearl for repairs, and that's where they found the remaining remains of their sailors. So, and then the kamikaze attacks and killed people there, just the regular accidents underway. So there was a lot of loss of life on there. So that those stories, I would say, started seeing spirits like Charlie and whatnot started back in the 50s probably and continued through all the way up to her service until 91 when she was decommed.
The haunted house, when did that decision happen?
Rocco allowed that to happen. He was the museum director at the time. He allowed that to happen, let's see, I left in 2015, so around 2013. So, man, almost 10 years. Yeah, that's 9 years now that that AB's been running that. And it is a good cause. Some of the proceeds go to Wounded Warriors. So definitely like supporting that.
Were there any new additions to the SIFs or exhibits that were opened up while you were there?
Always. I mean, too many to number. They're always adding exhibits and changing. So, yeah, various numerous ones. And it's good to see that with the new director is doing good stuff, too. So every time I go on board, I make it a point to find somebody there, manager or whatever there, just, you know, shake their hand and just say, hey, tell the crew good job. The ship looks great. The exhibits are awesome. They're getting much more high-tech, more technology, audio, video, and stuff. So, can't say enough about the Lexington staff. They're always doing good stuff, keeping the exhibits interesting and up-to-date.
Do all the staff members perform maintenance and create the exhibits?
You can definitely be asked to, if you want overtime, hey, everybody wants overtime, you can come in on a Saturday or Sunday on board the ship, sure, and help put up signage, maybe work on a laptop computer. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that still goes on, I'm sure.
What made you decide to become a JROTC instructor?
Interacting while I worked on the overnight program on Lex, interacting with other instructors that came on board. They approached me knowing that I was a veteran, a Navy vet. Some Marine instructors said, hey, you'd be pretty good at this gig called ROTC instructing. A retired Master Chief with one of the groups said the same thing. So I finally listened to the Master Chief, put in the paperwork required to get certified by the Navy to become a certified Naval Science Instructor. And that's a board once a year, I'm sorry, twice a year now. Twice a year meets, back then it was Pensacola, now it's in Great Lakes, Illinois. But they go over retired sailors, they go over our records, scrub them. And if we're worthy, they certify us, and then you just apply like any other civilian job. Look for job openings and apply for it, resume and all that, and and the certified letter, in this case, you have to have your certified letter from the Navy saying that you're certified to be an instructor. And that's how I got the position here at Carroll back in 15, the 15-16 school year.
Was it hard transitioning from a museum worker to a ROTC instructor?
Well, let's see. In a way, yes, because, of course, one of the duties of our JRTC is being a coach. So I didn't have to do any coaching whatsoever on Lexington. So learning that, patience, how hard can teaching drill be, coaching drill? Well, apparently it's pretty freaking hard. So, and you were in the arm block with us, of course, Jacob. So right to left, you would think it's pretty simple. But so frustrating and me learning patience there with the youngins. It's still the struggle is real today too, but we're getting there. That's rewarding too. That's the rewarding part of the job. Maybe I need to do more of that. Show like record the first or second practice, and then at the end of the drill season, show a much better drill team by then. And to show, hey, you guys, two left feet here, and look at this. Now you're up there like a Flower Bluff drill team, nice and sharp and polished. So yeah, that's the rewarding fact for me. Of this job is that. Just seeing the kids develop freshmen all the way through senior year. And then becoming like yourself, young adults, moving on to college and bigger and better things.
Do you get to see formal cadets often?
A few. Run into them at odd places, out in town, at their various jobs and stuff like that. And cadets like yourself, return cadets come through. A couple others came and helped out with CCISD, which we hosted a drill meet. We hosted a couple weeks ago. So, yeah, and that's kind of good, too, that you made some kind of an impact on their life. And they come back and just want to and they're alumni, too. So they just want to, check in with the unit, see if it's still doing good. And we are. We're still here doing good stuff at Carroll.
How was the recent drill meet?
It went well. We had a lot of lessons learned. This is a much larger campus. We learned that. Can't just snap my fingers and you can go and take care of a problem for me, because that problem might be out on the track field. Well, you know, the old campus with the portables, the track field was right there, spitting distance. It ain't anymore. In my mind, I'm still thinking, it's just right there, just take a minute. No, it takes 15 minutes now to leave from this point, go out there and come back. So learning the size of the campus, and we might get stuff like radios next year. We might bust out some radios or something with the cadets to make it go a little bit more efficient. Mm-hmm. All kinds of, yeah, we got, me and Warren got all kinds of ideas, make it better. But it was good. We received, the input was well, yeah, from the principal on down to the other instructors that were here. So we did good, and that's our tradition here.
Do you still do community service at the Lexington with the cadets?
Yes, constantly. At least three times a year, I would say. About three times a year we do. Yeah, we like going to Lexington, and they love having us.
Out of all your jobs in the Navy and the Lexington and as a ROTC instructor, what would you say was your favorite?
Oh, my favorite, I would have to say, that's tough. They're all good. But if I had to say favorite, I'm going to go way back to when I was, 19, 20 years old, and ADAC, Alaska, tracking a lot of Soviet targets was exciting. And knowing that data was being sent directly to the White House, President Reagan at the time, it was pretty good. It was a pretty good feeling. I mean, that was something, yeah. The Cold War was real. If you guys only knew how close we came. Scary, too, coming to nuclear annihilation.
As a ending question, what do you think the Lexington provides for the community, and how can the community help the Lexington?
Oh, definitely what the Lexington provides for the community. Definitely the tourist revenue that it brings in. So helping out local businesses, that's being restaurants, hotels, motels, of course, the shopping that's brought in. So the tourist commerce point of it, that definitely is something Lexington brings in. And it's a living history. By that I mean you're there, you're walking on a World War II aircraft carrier. Phenomenal to me. She was launched in 18 months, maybe 16 months. I don't know. No, it was less than 2 years, I know that. There was nothing, and then there was a World War II aircraft carrier, almost 40,000 tons displacement. So you learn that living history going on there, the sacrifice of our of that generation, the World War II vets, and what they went through and how they lived on board the ship, how they fought the ship, all that. And great exhibits as we did, so that contributes to that living history. So, I mean, you don't even have to read. So you can go through now, and they've got the high tech is so you can put in some earphones on your smartphone and listen to the exhibits as you walk through. So a lot of great exhibits going on, a lot of audiovisual stuff to see. And for the community to help out to make sure Lex stays here, and because it costs a lot, guys. I mean, I was just on there yesterday to go through the haunted house to see what the procedures are going to be this year for the kiddos that are going to be actors. Our cadets go there and help out by being the ghost in this haunted house. And her starboard forward section there, the starboard is all being rusted over, so they're grinding it, putting primer on it, going to repaint it. So constant maintenance and upkeep. So just go to the ship. If you're in Corpus, every couple months if you can, you got a downtime on a Sunday, they're open 7 days a week, go to the Lex, take your kids there or something, support them that way. They do charity events on board, so go and do that, from dances to other events. And and the biggest one, I'd say, just visit the Lex from time to time. I think that sums it up in a nutshell.
How was the haunted house started?
It was started by a gentleman. I just know him as A.B. because I can't pronounce his last name. My Espanol is not so good. But really good guy. He did what's called confined rescue training. So he trained guys who work on oil fields, out in the oil fields, refineries, and offshore platforms, confined spaces, how to fight a fire and how to get injured people out of confined spaces. And the Lexington is where he would train them up on that. He got the idea, ran it by the boss out there, which was Rocco at the time, the director, got approval for it, and that's how it got started back in about 2013 or so.
This wraps the end of the recording. Anything that you want to add, Signal Chief?
No, I don't believe so. I think you did a good job there, Jacob.